Support for WPR comes from The Alliance, a not-for-profit cooperative that contracts with over 39,000 healthcare providers on its employers' behalf to help them access healthcare. The-Alliance.org. Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, where visitors can experience campus and learn about Luther's 60-plus academic programs, like engineering science, nursing, and music education. luther.edu/visit.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later, we'll look at political fundraising in Wisconsin and see what lawmakers are raking in the big bucks.
First, in our Curious Wisconsin segment, we talk with two guests who set out to answer the question, how did a Wisconsin chair company producing records on the cheap build one of the greatest musical rosters ever assembled under one roof?
It's the story of Paramount Records, a label born in Grafton, Wisconsin, in the early parts of the 20th century. While the tale of Paramount has mostly flown under the radar in the years since its collapse, a group of devoted individuals is rekindling interest in the music and the stories behind it.
We've got two guests with us now, starting with Dean Blackwood. He's the co-founder of Revenant Records and worked with musician Jack White to release a new box set called The Rise and Fall of Paramount Records, 1917 to 1932, Volume 1. Dean, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
And we're also joined by his brother, Scott Blackwood. Scott is a writer, novelist, and professor of English at Southern Illinois University. He wrote a book that's included in the box set that chronicles the history of the label. And Scott, it's good to have you, too.
Thanks for having us, yeah.
And Dean, let's start with you. So the origin story of Paramount Records, it's quirky. Now, you've got a Wisconsin chair company in Grafton in the early 20th century. How does it go from being primarily a place that manufactures things you sit on to a record company?
Right. Well, I mean, it wasn't because of any abiding interest in music, that's for sure. They really just wanted to sell these expensive phonograph cabinets that they'd started manufacturing. They worked as a contract manufacturer for Thomas Edison for his outfit in Orange, New Jersey. When his factory burned down, he had no place to manufacture the phonograph cabinets he'd been producing, and so he hired Wisconsin Chair Company to do that. They learned that the reason to be in the record business was really to be in the expensive phonograph cabinet business and to drive sales of furniture, essentially. And so that's how they sort of stumbled into being a record label in the first place. They spent the first 5 years or so steadily going out of business, and it finally occurred to them that maybe it did matter what was actually on the records. And so beginning in 1922, they embarked on what was called at the time race music or race records, which was essentially the music of black performers for black audiences.
Yeah, it's an interesting point to think about, isn't it, Scott? You've got this group of Caucasian guys in rural Wisconsin and a chair company who think, you know, we manufacture phonograph compartments. Why don't we just do the records, too? How did they become a launching pad for African-American musicians?
It seems like their whole intent was along the lines of, Edison is, you know, they wanted to just make a buck in the bottom line. And as Dean had mentioned, you know, before this, people didn't even really put the labels or the names of the artists on the records. Edison had, you know, most of his people didn't even have names on them. So there was a big shift in 1920 when Mamie Smith has this huge hit, the first huge blues hit, Crazy Blues. And, as Dean had mentioned, they were putting out anything, you know, just throwing up things against the wall during this period, 1917 to 1920, and just seeing what would stick. They had no idea. Their German, Scandinavian, Mexican ethnic music, whatever, oompah bands, you know, whatever, they're not really sure what will stick. But once Mamie Smith hits, they reconfigure, and they figure out, you know, we've got to get some people to get to know this music first, but they had no idea where to start. And they were really fortunate in that a man named Mayo Williams,
Right, he's the producer who got the nickname Ink, right?
Right, for signing, he was incredible at signing people up, and it's a mixed bag with Mayo Williams. He's this incredible figure. He was a graduate of Brown University, African American man, graduate of Brown University, was one of the first NFL players in Hammond, Indiana.
Wow.
He was good friends with Paul Robeson, the singer, and just had been working for a label in New York. And as it turned out, it's Harry Pace's label there, and it was the first African American label. So he knew bits and pieces of this industry, but had no real certainly no managerial experience, and literally went up from, he was living in Chicago, basically doing record subscriptions, the kind of subscriber list, and he gets this idea in his mind. He knows where Paramount is and how they're sitting kind of on the edge of something, and so he makes a cold call, essentially goes up from Chicago to Port Washington. Passed through Grafton, and he to get a feel for things, and it's an unusual sight at this time for a black man to be a well-dressed black man to be walking through town.
Rural Wisconsin, yeah.
Yeah, and so he literally, as he said later, he said, "I just jived my way into the whole thing. I had no idea what was going to happen, but he convinced them."
Yeah, he did right by them. He brought an incredible roster of artists, and I want to get to some of the music so people can hear some of what he brought. One of the first, Ma Rainey is one of the big names that came out of Paramount Records. Let's take a listen, and then we can have you tell us a little bit about it. This is the song "Take Me to the Basement."
I've got a man.
And clip there of the artist Ma Rainey. Dean, can you tell us something about her?
Yeah, she was one of the first big hit artists for Paramount. Sold tons of records, recorded a ton of records for them, and she was one of the folks that Mayo Williams brought to the label. Basically, he was their connection to black nightlife in Chicago, which is where initially they did much of their scouting for talent through Mayo Williams. He, of course, had entree to all the nightclubs and theaters where folks like Ma Rainey and Ethel Waters and Alberta Hunter and others were holding court each night. And Ma Rainey was one of these theater singers, although she had come from a little bit of a different background and kind of honed her chops in sort of the tents of vaudeville-style shows. Dating back to, pre-turn of the century. So by the time she records in the early 20s for Paramount, she's already well into her career. But she brought a grittiness to this sort of what they called theater blues. She certainly doesn't sound like anyone else, man or woman, from that time. And really had a sense of her sort of place in that world, a great stage presence, a really huge confidence on stage, and she was a big woman and used her size to her advantage and moved around well on the stage.
Yeah, well, she's got a gorgeous voice, and we're going to hear more of the music that came out of Paramount Records coming up as we talk with Scott and Dean Blackwood about the story of Paramount Records, which, believe it or not, was born right here in Wisconsin around Port Washington and Grafton. We've got a lot more of that story coming up in a few moments.
First, Jean Purcell joins us in the studio because it's our Wisconsin Public Radio Winter Membership Drive. As a WPR listener, you know you're always going to hear something worthwhile when you tune in. Stories just like this one. Now is the time for you to put a value on that. Support this program and everything else you hear on WPR with your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2000. 2552.
And we are looking forward to hearing from you. Last hour, by the way, we heard from 61 of you, new and returning members to Wisconsin Public Radio. And before we go any further, a big thank you for all of those pledges.
Some exciting news now this hour. We have a dollar-for-dollar match up to $2,600. This generous match is from current members, including donors from Madison and Baraboo. What does that mean? It means they're going to match every dollar you give. It's their way of encouraging you to join them in supporting Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's simple economics, really a great chance for you to make your pledge dollars go further this hour only. So get your pledge doubled right now. It really is a great opportunity to support Wisconsin Public Radio and make your pledge go farther. Make your pledge, WPR.org, or at 888-202-2552.
You turn to WPR for smart conversations about compelling topics. You can count on hearing in-depth, thought-provoking discussions all day, every day. Because WPR is listener-supported public radio, your gift now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 makes all the difference. It makes these discussions possible.
It does. It makes the discussion you're hearing about Paramount Records and their presence here in Wisconsin possible, and giving to a WPR is easy to do. It really is. All it takes, just a few minutes of your time, and then a gift of any amount, say $10 a month.
That donation will come back to you every day in the form of great programs. Show your support right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 and give as generously as you can.
Now when we travel, I've got WPR's app for the iPhone. We listen to WPR all the time we're driving, 14, 15 hours a day sometimes, all across the country. This station has by far the best programming of any public radio station I've found anywhere in the country. This is prime programming. People should know that. People should be aware of it. People should know that there's something really intelligent happening right here in our midst. When we gave annually, you got a good feeling when you wrote the check. Now, as a sustainer, I'm reminded monthly. It does make you feel a bit more a part of the process, more a part of the entire effort to put intelligent programming on the air. We like the idea that we're putting our money where our values are. I'm Bruce from Brookfield, Wisconsin. Join me as a sustainer of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Pledge now and become a sustainer at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Rob Ferret here with Gene Purcell asking for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio during our winter membership drive. Maybe your gift is $10 a month or $20 a month. Whatever amount you choose is the right amount at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And when you choose that amount, remember that we've got a dollar-for-dollar match in effect right now, money coming to us from current members, including donors in Madison and Baraboo. And what it means, your gift of $50 turns into $100. $100 doubles up to $200 and so on. So a great opportunity to take advantage of this match to make your gift go even further in paying for WPR programming. Get your pledge matched dollar for dollar, and you can do it right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Maybe you listened to WPR in school as a kid or in the car with your parents, or maybe you just found us a few months ago. Either way, you probably want to see WPR continue. It's an important part of your life, an important part of Wisconsin.
And if you've been listening for a long time when you were a kid with your parents in the car, but you've never given before, now really is the time to do your part. It's never too late to make that first contribution of, say, well, $5 a month. It's easy. It doesn't take long. Just go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Think of your contribution to WPR as an investment in your future listening. Give us just a few minutes of your time and your donation in any amount. In return, you'll get lots of great programs.
Donate at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. And in just those few minutes, 2, 3, or 4 minutes, you'll have made a wise investment, once that will pay dividends every single day.
And right now is a great time to make your pledge because of that dollar-for-dollar match in effect. It's from current listeners who put up some money to help encourage you to make your pledge. Maybe your first ever pledge right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And thanks to those listeners for their support. And when you make your pledge, ask for the new WPR logo t-shirt with your pledge of $120 or more. Just $10 a month, ask for the t-shirt at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Tom from Brooklyn pledged. He says, I listen to WPR every day. I wake up to it. I listen to it while I drive. Well, is Tom like you? Join Tom with your pledge right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552, and thank you. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Scott and Dean Blackwood about the history of Paramount Records, what started as a project of the Wisconsin Share Company in Grafton and Port Washington in the early 20th century, became a launching pad for some of the most legendary jazz and blues musicians of all time, and it happened right here in Wisconsin. And before we go too much farther, I want to bring in some more music. This is maybe the biggest name, at least certainly one of them, to come out of this era, Blind Lemon Jefferson. This is Black Snake Moan.
I ain't got no mama now. I ain't got no mama now. She told me late last night, you don't need no mama no how.
And a clip there from Black Snake Moan of Blind Lemon Jefferson. And Scott, tell us a little bit about that artist. He's a big one.
Yeah, he's essentially the first, you know, rock star of blues. He's a male, obviously, who's accompanying himself on guitar. And this is the first, you know, this is the model that people think about often when they think of the blues. And he's just a huge hit for them. And, you know, again, they were kind of throwing things at the wall, see what would stick. And he changes everything for him. He even becomes a bigger seller than Ma Rainey. He's from Texas. He's from Wortham, Texas, outside of Dallas. And he was discovered there in Dallas, in the Deep Ellum neighborhood of Dallas. And was brought up, just essentially they put him on a train and had him come up and record. And
yeah, I want to ask you about that. What was it like to have these African-American artists who are, you know, at the top of their game? At the time, it's hard for them to get the recording contracts they might if they were white artists, but these are incredible recordings. And they just show up in Port Washington and they record. Can you talk a little bit about what that recording scene was like, Dean?
Yeah, well, they actually they didn't start recording in Wisconsin until pretty late in Paramount's life. They did most of the recording out of Chicago initially because they didn't have their own studio. It was hard at the time to set up a recording studio, and so they relied upon different studios in the Chicago area. But in the later years, beginning in like 28, 29. You did have folks like Blind Lemon Jefferson and Blind Blake, Charlie Patton, Son House, and a lot of the really famous early blues artists coming to a place like Grafton to visit and record there in the studio they had built. And it certainly was, as Scott mentioned, it was still an unusual sight. However many years after Mayo Williams' first visit to town, to see these African American artists walking around the streets of Grafton or Port Washington, where the offices were, the studio and the record factory were in Grafton, with the offices of Paramount a little bit further up the road in Port Washington. So. It was a little bit of a collision of worlds, especially because a lot of these artists had never been outside of their hometowns, you know, wherever they were coming from. Some from Mississippi, some from Texas, Alabama, Louisiana, lots of places, making their way in a sort of mini version of the Great Migration northward. So, very interesting time.
Scott, did Paramount Records know what it had in these artists? Did they know how important and incredible these recordings were?
They had no idea. Absolutely no idea. It was, You know, they knew that they would sell. They didn't really know why they were selling often. I mean, Maya Williams had a good idea, but the rest of them really didn't know. Or what would sell next. So they were just casting a net by this point, you know, far and wide to find the next Lima Jefferson. And that's how inadvertently someone like Blind Blake gets found, is because Maya Williams was upset that someone had, Arthur Labley, one of the production managers at Paramount, had claimed discovery. And so there's this kind of internal war going on, too, at times between Maya Williams and some of the other folks about the next move, you know, who got credit for it and those kind of things. So, yeah, it was a true collision in that sense. Yet, in meetings, Maya Williams was still taking the freight elevator up, like when they would meet in Chicago.
Oh, boy.
So it's quite a, you know, but they don't know what they have, and and that's why they, you know, they essentially are just casting around, because they don't understand their audience at all. So that changes when they come up with these scouts that are in, and they already had them in place, but they began to use them more and more in the South, who really did understand African Americans and what they wanted and what they cared about. And so,
well, we've got to make sure we get to the end of the story here. By 1932, Paramount went out of business. Dean, what happened?
Well, it was you know, it was the Depression. I think that's, you know, maybe the beginning and the end of the story. In the end, they while they had a lot of you know, a lot of hit records, you know, they had never been particularly focused on quality. So they were, you know, when it came time for people to discard frivolous things, when money became tight, I think Paramount perhaps was the easiest to let go of. They didn't seem like prestige items, you know, in terms of they didn't focus a lot on the quality of the material that went into the records, meaning the actual physical material into, you know, the shellac, as they call it, the stuff into which the records were pressed, was really low quality. And so they didn't have a lot of customer loyalty to fall back on, like some of the companies that survived the Depression and are still around in some form today.
We're running up short of time here, but I want to ask you both about, what do you see as the legacy of Paramount today? What do these recordings mean, Scott, in our last 30 seconds or so?
Well, I think they influenced everything that was to come, culturally and musically, because each of these, once these records were out there, and many of them were carried by Pullman porters on the trains all across America. And so they were distributed that way, and by mail. They influenced all these musicians, including, you know, early records that Paramount put out influenced Charlie Patton, and then Charlie Patton went on to influence, you know, all the Delta, and then from that, you know, you get to Sun Records, and from that you get on into the modern era.
And on it goes. Well, Scott and Dean, thank you so much for joining us today. We've been talking with Scott and Dean Blackwood about the history of Paramount Records, which was born right here in Wisconsin.
Coming up after the news, a look at political fundraising in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. All right.